Today's sponsor is Home Theater Solutions. Absolutely love these guys. HTS is your local technology expert, serving Delaware for 16 years. Home Theater Solutions specializes in TV installations, home automations, Sonos audio systems, security cameras, and Wi-Fi networks. For all of your home and business tech needs, give them a call, 1-800-690-2029, or visit htsav.net. All right, welcome back. This is the Rehoboth Social Podcast, part of the Social Podcast Network, www.socialpodcastnetwork.com. Local folks doing local podcasts. Good morning, good morning. It is, what's today? 10-13, Wednesday. Good morning.
How are you?
I'm doing good. What's the latest, buddy?
Well, I'm in here to talk about that book that I had written, and it's been about 3 months since it's been out.
Yeah, so Mark D. Ambrosi.
That's it.
That was a tough one, but I got it. And your book is More Than One Goal, A Story About Strength, Hope, Faith, Family, and the Power of Love. It's a lot.
It is.
It's not that thick. It's a shortened version of your concept on all of this.
Exactly. It touches on all those subjects. Let's put it that way.
Well, listen, I appreciate you coming on the podcast. I love chatting with folks. And listen, I think we've all at some point thought that we would like to write a book.
I agree with you. I hear that all the time.
And you stepped through and did it.
It's been a work in progress for a long time.
So how do you start? I mean, clearly you need a story. Clearly you have got to have a great opinion of the story. And then you got to put the paper to the, or pen to the paper. You did all these things. I mean, what good experience? You know, what do you think?
It was an interesting experience. It was good. It was great. It was, you know, tedious. It's all those things that you think it might. Well, it's all those things and more. You know, I didn't know that it would be as involved. When I say tedious, you know, you get the edits and then you got to rewrite and you get the edits and you rewrite again. So that was a learning proposition. You know, that throughout that whole process, I went in it as a novice and consider myself to be one because it's the first time I've ever done this. I had a story from growing up that I thought was interesting.
Okay.
You know, it's unlike many other people, their experiences growing up. So I wrote that a long time ago, probably 15 years ago. You know, probably 40 pages of that book is an experience that I had in my teens that was kind of the centerpiece of it. And then I wrote essentially a story leading up to it and then a story following it. It's a fictional tale because I'll get to that later, but I don't remember everything exactly the way it was, and I don't want to do a memoir that's kind of, there's two reasons, but one of which is I don't want to have something not be true. I read James Frey's book about A Million Little Pieces, and it's a memoir, and I remember some things about going to a rehab facility, and I thought that it was inaccurate, and then as it turns out, it was inaccurate, so I didn't want to run through that whole scenario, but I also thought that there's more interesting ways of putting some of these stories. And the reason I say it that way is I don't know that my life is so worthy, but I thought if I put in some more interesting facts, put in some more interesting things, it'd make a more interesting tale.
Yeah, I agree. So, but a story about strength, hope, faith, family, and the power of love. I mean, that's a lot of stuff. How can you what do you want to talk about first? Hope. I mean, where does, you know, what's the message? You know, I've talked to several people that have, you know, wanted to come on a podcast. I talked to a guy that wanted to do a podcast. You know, and my question is always, well, what's this about? Is this to help folks or is this to help yourself? Is this about others or is this about self? And I'm not sure. I think you have to have a little of both, right? You have to have a little of self. You want to get your story out.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, hope, faith, family, and strength, those are all things that help others.
And the thing with the hope that you bring up is that we all find normally, in most instances, you have some sort of desperation in your life. Mm. And then when you have that desperation, unless you have some hope, unless you have some faith in you and God, whatever your faith might be, but you have to have some blind faith and some hope that things will get better. And then it's up to you to either make them better or not. But hope is what I find in my story or in the book story is hope is a I reached a sense of desperation, and then through that, I found a way to believe that what I could do was going to make my life better, and that's the pursuit, essentially.
So that is kind of the key. You have to have that moment, right? Ego devastation, humiliation is usually the key to change. I always say, you know, nothing changes a life like shame and guilt.
There's some truth in that right there.
Well, that's speaking for me. I have all of my big changes are right after some shame and guilt. And how do you, and you kind of mentioned a little bit like a moment. Was there a moment, you know, maybe not shame or maybe not guilt, but was there a moment that, you know, made you feel like you were hoping that there was hope?
Yes. So there's several instances through it, but what you have, and so part of the book is about alcoholism and then reaching, quote, your bottom line, your lowest point.
Right.
And so you think that you're there and then you manage to get lower, and then you think you're there and then you manage to get lower. And there's several steps through that, you know, where you just are, it's in a darker period. And then once you get to that bottom line, then I realized, you know, this is where I am. It was, for me, it was getting told that you're going to rehab, you know, basically like, and then sitting there as a 20-year-old kid and looking around at people that I could not relate to at all based on what they looked like, based on, because I don't know who they are. I'm right. Sitting there in my first big, I'd gone to AA meetings because I had gotten a DUI. So I was in that situation where I understood what it was, but I was in denial the whole time. So I'm not sitting there with an open mind at these AA meetings. I'm just there to get my paper signed so I can turn it into my probation officer. Right. You know, and that's what you're looking at. Yeah. That's who I am at that point. And then I sit in this meeting and I'm like, who are all these people and how do I fit into any of this? And that was like kind of an area where I was like, what's going on? So there's a change that occurs after you reach that, like, this is who I am. I'm a 20-year-old kid in a rehab facility surrounded by a bunch of addicts. That's, I guess, who I am. And that's what I felt like was not my lowest point, because you do a bunch of stupid stuff that hurts physically and hurts mentally. But that was a point where I found hope more than anything. I was a sense of, I'm here, I'm on my own. I'm just this guy in a spot, in a chair, in a sterile building, looking at people I've never met before and never planned on.
I can relate. I mean, there was some time, I mean, at 15, 16, I was struggling with marijuana and alcohol, and I don't think I was an alcoholic. I think, you know, we can talk about the definition of alcoholism, but, you know, I remember, you know, my mom's like, you're going to go to a rehab. And I'm like, and I wasn't looking for hope. I was like, hopefully they would forget about sending me to a rehab. That was the only hope I had. I had no desire. I always say, I didn't become an alcoholic until the day I quit drinking. Up until that point, I just drank a lot.
Right.
You know, there's this transition that takes place, you know, from, oh, I got caught, you know, to, you know, how I hope I can get out of this. But I had no desire to quit anything at 19 and 20 years old. So good for you to have been able to see that. I know that I couldn't see that at that age. And you know, it's taken me 50-something years to get to a point in my life where I can actually start seeing that, you know, the sobriety side of things are more self-based. The serenity part is the part I focus on today, and that's the less self. That's more of the humility-based, you know, waving that white flag, surrendering. It's good. It's fine. You can win. It's fine. You know, just basically, you know, not fighting everything on every turn and shift in the road like I used to. You know, if someone said the sky was blue, I'd say it was dark blue. You know, if it was windy, I would say it was breezy. It was always, you know, I couldn't be like, that's great. So, but to have that state of mind at 20 years old, that's pretty awesome.
Well, it didn't come easily, put it that way. Right. You know, I would tell you that I had hurt myself and then hurt myself again and hurt myself again. Like, there was a gradual decline in my behavior and in my actions to the point where that was the sense of desperation. And then, you know, that loneliness that I think most people feel, whether you're an alcoholic or you're just a general person who's going through tough times, you get that loneliness. And that's really where I felt it. And then I was like, if I can do something different, maybe my life will be different, you know, because it was, you know, when you disappoint people consistently. Yeah. You know, I had a loving family. That's the one thing I kind of write about in this book is I didn't have an excuse. I wasn't abused. I wasn't abandoned. I wasn't a product of a dysfunctional, broken home. You know, a lot of things that instigate some people using to use drugs or to drink because they were escaping. Mm-hmm. I just liked it. You know what I mean? I drank to get drunk from pretty much the beginning, you know? And then I often believe that alcohol leads to your next bad decision, you know, whatever that might be. And I never had like a reason. I liked it. I did what I did because it made me feel good for that moment and that moment later. And then the regret and all the stuff that comes along with it obviously comes down the road, but I didn't have any reason to disappoint these people, yet I constantly did. Right. You know, and that's your family, that's your siblings, that's your teacher, your coach, your boss, your whatever you were that, you know, they look at me and I'm like, there he goes again kind of thing. And then that's where it was. And then it's self-fulfilling. Then I'm like, I'm a screw up. So, of course, I'm going to undermine myself and go screw up again. So this isn't a self-pity thing. I'm telling you, it's just the thought process that a lot of people go through. And I found that what I wrote has identified with a lot. It's amazing to get. I'm going on, but I don't want to keep going, but emails from 75-year-old guys who said, you know what, I really could identify, and 25-year-old kids who say, it feels like you're telling a lot of my own story.
I think that one of the biggest problems is, like, especially, you know, an alcoholic, right? You know, so you would think, oh, well, an alcoholic is someone that drinks too much. But to me, the disease isn't the drinking. It's a byproduct. The disease is... I identify myself as a self-centered asshole with a deficiency in humility. That's my condition.
We all have that.
That's right.
The humility part. We struggle with that.
If it said, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable, right away that excludes a giant group of people, right? Because, you know, you're not an alcoholic until the day after you quit. Right. Until then, you just drink a lot. But if it said, we admitted we were powerless over self, that our lives have become unmanageable. It really should say, we admit we're powerless over self, that our lives have become unmanageable to everybody else.
Yeah, we're not the problem. It's everybody else.
Well, and you know, my parents, my boss, my friends, they'd all had it with my behavior. I personally was okay. I could have gone a little longer. I was like, eh, what's stitches, right? I mean, the only reason I even got sober is because I got punched in the mouth at Mulligan's.
Enough times?
Just once.
No.
It was enough for me. I ran my big freaking mouth. Last call. Give me another. I need two. Just disgusting human. And this guy punched me in the mouth. And I've talked about it before. I will never forget. Bleeding on all fours. Bleeding from my mouth. Watching Bill, the bartender, come over. And the first thing I think of is not like, oh, you've run your mouth again, Tom. Oh, your behavior has caused you to get in another jam. It's like... Bill likes me. He's going to help me.
Yes. Bill, yeah, you believe everybody.
And he's going to come help me. And Bill picked me up and threw me out the front door. And I said, March 31st, 1997, sitting on the Rehoboth Avenue, going, not my first thought, oh, I drink too much. I should really get sober. I don't want to explain these stitches to the guys that I work with. That was being enough. That it would take years to get to that honesty. That's why I got sober.
Because
I didn't want to explain... I didn't want to look like a pussy.
Well, and you don't, and you just steer clear of the truth so often.
Yep.
You know, and that's the part that's
and then I hid it, BB.
Difficult.
I hid there. I like to say, you know, the year I got sober, I was like, yeah, I went to BB, got sober. No, I hid there. You know, it takes this transition over time to really get to the truth of it all. And I hid there. I didn't want to explain the stitches. And luckily, it stuck. But, you know, it's a disease of self. You know, donuts don't get us put in jail. It's unfortunate.
Unfortunate.
I wish they did, right? You know, whether it's money, sex, alcohol, drugs, food, whatever it is, it's just that fork in the road. We like to do what we want and not what we should do.
And a lot of that is an awakening that I write about. And then it's an interesting book, and I'm not just trying to say that because I wrote it. It's an interesting book.
Because we're here to promote your book, so let's be honest. It's interesting, right?
I think it is.
Let's pump this book up.
I talk about you don't listen to your parents. You know, you don't listen to those that love you because you're convinced that they've got it out for you, or they're just being a pain, or they're just trying to be an annoyance. So I spend some time with my grandmother, who is just not just a voice of reason, but is an experienced voice of life. And I remember some of the things that she told me, and it's not word for word, and I didn't want to get into that, so that's why it's a fictional tale. But you get that wise, older voice to tell you that toughen up. You know, like you think your life is bad. You've had it pretty good. So it's not about you and disappointing your parents and all that stuff. It's about you just making sure that it's time for you to do what you're supposed to do. Yeah. And there's a, you know, an awareness that comes along with that where you're like, this 75, 80 year old lady's telling me to stop being such a wimp, stop being such a selfish kid and grow up. And they had it a lot tougher than we did back then. And I didn't realize it. And there's just a lot of awareness that comes along with
a lot. Did they have it tougher?
I think they did. You know, truthfully, when I say that.
Physically, maybe, but I personally think we live in the toughest time right now.
The reason I say that is there's self-sufficiency taught to them at the age of 12, 14, 16 that we still hold hands with our kids and allow, you know. And
so it's tougher now.
For who?
Us people, I think.
I think growing up in those days was probably tougher. We have way more options. We can travel a lot more. We have more awareness of things because of the internet and everything. But
yeah, but do you think this ability to have so much, do you think it creates, I think it creates more drama, more
anxiety,
more stress. I think, you know, back in the 50s, you know, you got up, you worked, you came home, you ate dinner, you watched a little television or read the paper, listened to the radio, and you went to bed.
It was more simple.
It was much more simple, yes. Maybe a little more physical. Yeah, you maybe walked more, a little more physical in the labor department. But, you know, there's nothing like doing a hard day's work and then laying down and being like with a clear mind, you know, great day. But today it's hard to end the day because we're so much information all day and so many topics and subjects and situations where even though it's none of our business, we'd love to get in there and roll our sleeves up and try to fix everything.
And make it our
business.
And
have an opinion and... It's exhausting. I loved when I was a kid. I loved being the kid in 1986. You know, we didn't have the phones and I'm just getting old, I suppose. But it was better. It was a better time.
I think it was an easier time. It was, and that's when this is based basically. It's 1986 to you know, and then it goes all the way to present day, but 1986 to 1996 is the period of time where a lot of this stuff occurs. And so I think you could identify with a lot of the references, essentially. But what would be considered my grandparents' age was a tougher time physically, and it was also a time of more maturity at a younger age. And so that's what I try to bring forth.
Yeah. No, that's great. So how'd the process go? You wrote the book? I mean, I think there's probably a lot of people that are listening that have thought about writing a book. I've thought about it. My problem is I'm not a big writer. I'm not a great typer. I skipped that class. So I could never get the pencil to the paper. But, of course, I feel like I've got some great ideas and a book would be good. So how do you get started? What I would think for me would be a good idea is maybe to sit down and try to write a page. This was a little plan that I had. I'm like, maybe I can just sit down and maybe write a page a night. But that never even happened. So how do you get this? How do you get started? I mean, how do you get into the routine where you actually finish and have a book?
Well, the way it worked for me, and I can't speak from everybody's experience but my own, but the way it worked for me is I had that middle piece of the puzzle, which I thought was interesting. And if you notice, there's a lacrosse, that's me in 1970 something as a lacrosse kid on the cover walking with my sticks.
Like, and that was Sears Roebuck socks.
Yeah, that was on Lacrosse Magazine, which is what the kids have these days, in 1970. I can't remember the year. I was about 10 or 12 years old. That was on the cover, and I remember going to a game and seeing it, and I was like, that's me. So I called the guy. This isn't related to writing the book, but I called the guy and said, can I use that as the cover? So I had the story, getting back to that, and I wrote leading up to it. I thought it was more character development because I'm an inexperienced novelist, essentially. And I wrote that growing up in the suburban setting, lacrosse is an influence, but it's also introduction to, you know, when you start drinking, when you start living the life of a teenager in, you know, suburban middle America, and then go through into college. And then, so how I did it, we spent a long time where we didn't turn the TV on during the week because the kids were doing homework. Well, I'm not going to look over their shoulder every night to do their homework. So I just started writing into it leading up and then afterwards while they did their homework. And then at 10 o'clock, I'd put it down. So it would be three nights a week. I'd write from 8 o'clock to 10 o'clock and just do it. And because TV's off, the music's not playing, it was kind of a quiet time, and I was able to do that. And then what I've learned through this whole experience is I have a cousin who's been involved in sports TV and all that. So I said, hey, I got a book. I got an idea for a lacrosse movie. It's a story about a kid. And he's like, it'll never work. And I was like, I think it'll work. And I kept being persistent with him. And he said, all right, send it to me. And I sent it to him. And this was, you know, photocopied paper or in an envelope kind of thing. It wasn't in a book by any means. And it takes, what I learned later, didn't know, is when you send something off, it takes 3 months for anybody to get back to you. So he calls me back in about a month and said, hey, I was on a flight from, you know, San Francisco back to Connecticut, and I read what you sent. And I was like, oh, yeah, what'd you think? And he's like, he prefaced it with, like, I fall asleep after three pages kind of thing. And when he started talking, I said, well, what'd you think? He said, it was gripping. I loved it. I thought it was super cool. I thought it's got a lot of interesting things. I love this parts that you put in there. I want to give it to somebody. Is it okay? So he gave it to a guy that he works with who's worked at Rolling Stone magazine. It's got a lot of the literary connections, essentially. He read it, gave me some edits, read it again, gave me some edits. And this was over probably a year period. Read it again. And then he said, publish it. So it took a long time, obviously, and that's the shortened version. But the guy who helped me out was a guy who worked at Rolling Stone and worked at ESPN and had a bunch of literary connections. So he connected me to somebody else who gave me some more information. And then it was either self-publish or send it to an agent. I sent it to two agents. One was way different book. So she said it wasn't for her. And I understood that. And then the other guy was like, he was already established and kind of on his way out. And he said, this is a big undertaking. I think you should self-publish. So that's what I did.
Yeah. And so what does that, what does that entail?
So, you know, I looked around and essentially Saltwater Media is in Berlin,
okay,
Berlin, Maryland, really nice people. Stephanie Fowler's her name. I sent it to her. She puts it in, she gets you the ISBN number, gets it in the library, you know, registers it with the Library of Congress, all those like technical things that she did. But she also put it in the form so it could be published. And then she gets you with, well, I forget the name of the publishing house, but then it's on Amazon and, you know, it's.
I think there's a publisher that's in Milton.
The Red Devil Press.
Yeah, Red Devil Press.
Yes. I reached out to them, but they weren't taking any new clients, for lack of a better term. So they weren't taking on any new clients.
Was that from just COVID?
They were just, I think they're just busy. Yeah. You know, I think it's pretty cool. But this was before COVID. So this was when it was all starting. And no, they were just busy. Good for them, you know. Yeah. They do a different kind of book. You know, there's this... different than just like a standard story. They have their niche with just a different style. So
it sounds like this book might have even had a different kind of idea or version when you initially started. Was it more going to be about like lacrosse, your journey through in lacrosse, and then you had to add some, you know, find some more facets, so to speak, on things to talk about?
Or it was more, it was interesting.
Has it always been a story about strength, hope, faith, family, and the power of love?
Yes, because like that, the beginning to the end has been the same. I had a longer beginning because I thought character development was really important, and it is, but you know, they were like, hey, get to the meat of the matter. You don't want to get to the real subject within the first 50-60 pages. So I had probably 100 pages written of a kid experiencing a whole bunch of stuff. When we're talking about the 60s, a whole bunch of stuff where you're on your bike flaunting or whatever, kind of going between adulthood of drinking beer, getting into trouble, and then innocence of playing ring and run all in the same day, you know, all in the same kind of story. And they were like, that's all cute. We don't need it. You know, and then there was multiple of those. You know, there's other scenarios where you're in the back of a car and you're making, you know, doing stuff. And it was an interesting thing where I thought that's what you did as in your lead up. So you have this detailed character and they're like, that's all cute, but really what you want to do is give us a plot and get to it right away. So that's what I learned through all those edits.
So they didn't want to hear a lot of the fill, like the fluff.
The early stuff, yeah. They were not too interested. I mean, they were like, all right, we like this story. We like that part. But the other things, just...
Where did you grow up?
The one guy that I said was on his way out, he said, I was wondering when you were going to get to any of the good stuff. You got to the good stuff, but boy, did that take too long. And I was like, okay. I grew up in the Baltimore area. Towson is the neighborhood. Okay. Which is a lacrosse neighborhood, kind of. That's what we did growing up. So I grew up in Towson in a great, like, you rode your bike to lacrosse practice, you played baseball, you hung out with your buddies in the neighborhood. It was a really easy lifestyle growing up. Went to the local Catholic school. You know, all the opportunities to be a good, wholesome, you know, upbringing were there, and we fulfilled those. And then, like a lot of kids, you romanticize the alcohol side. And I'm not just focused on that because there's a lot to the story, but you romanticize that when you see the adults and your older siblings and all that, and you think that's where all the fun is. And then, you know, next thing you know, you're in over your head.
Yeah, I try to figure out how I ended up where I ended up. In fact, I just did a podcast about this the other day. You know, my parents would have like a party, you know, and we'd discuss the party. The party would be discussed, you know, planned, you know, next month we're having the party, and you'd be like, oh, the party.
Yeah.
And then the menu would be kind of figured out and steaks. But, you know, over the month until the party, you'd hear tidbits. And then as we get closer, it would start to ramp up. And then that day, you know, the vibrations in the room would kind of change, and smells and colognes would appear, and
all of it. Yeah.
Vacuuming and just things, you know. And then the doorbell would ring, and then the people would start to show up. And I just remember as a little kid looking up, I would always wonder, why is everyone kissing my mother? You know, back in those days, everybody kissed everybody on the mouth. And I'd be like, why? Why is that? What's up with the kissing? And but then just how the vibrations would slowly change through the night, and then that start to ramp up, and then, you know, the amateurs and rookies would start to fall off, and then the pros would hang in there, and then, you know, lunch meats getting thrown around eventually. And
you'd hear things that you never would imagine would come out of somebody's mouth, and you're like, holy, did you hear that? You hear that?
Ooh. And my brother and I would sneak around the house, crawling through, you know, around speakers and stuff, just watching the party. And yeah, it was weird. I remember when I very first, you know, and you talked about how your experience was when you first started drinking. I was more, I remember drinking, and then I actually remember fake drinking. Did you ever do that?
Well, yeah, it's funny. That was one of the stories that I had put in early, like where you just, because you didn't know what you were getting involved in, but that you know, that got taken out. But well, yes, to answer your question.
That's a great story, honestly, because, you know, I remember hanging out with my friend Michelle, and somehow I was like, let's go to my parents' house, and we might have a liquor cabinet. And I just remember taking something and putting my mouth to it and tilting it up and not allowing the alcohol to go into my mouth, and then putting it down and then acting silly. Like, I just needed something to break this weird ice that I was going through as a teenager. So it was about, you know, feeling a part of, feeling, because up until then I didn't feel like I was good enough. I don't know, weird. It's tough being a teenager.
It is. And then once we got to a certain point, we became like periphery partiers. You know, that's all going on. And then we just took those opportunities to have our own thing off on the side. And then, you know, you just get good at it. And then you become, you know, then you just do whatever you want, whenever you want, because you become this person who can figure out how to get the beer, how to get the liquor, how to find your place, how to do it where you know, where you're away from everybody. So there's a development that grows with it. And then, you know, then there's a degradation essentially of your character. And then
you become a character.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You become someone you didn't know that you were until you kind of look in the mirror at some point. And then it goes further into, once you get sober, there's a whole awareness that comes about. And it's not like you have some clarity and all of a sudden you're like this mature person. There's a development that has to occur afterwards too, where you find out who you are, what you like, where you're going to end up, what you're going to do. There's a protagonist, obviously, because there's a scenario in there that I don't want to give it away because I want people to read it. But, you know, I get hurt pretty badly, and then, you know, that character comes back, and it's a story that I feel like I wrote to bring out emotion in the reader, whether it's bewilderment or disappointment or frustration or sadness, all those things. Is that when you asked me about like what was my goal or how did I write it, I wrote it to try to draw emotion out of the reader.
Do you have kids?
I do. I have three kids. They're 20, 18, two boys, and then a 16-year-old girl.
It's tough, especially like if you have any sort of sobriety or, you know, have kind of walked through that and come out on the other side. It's tough as a parent to not be a know-it-all. at least it is for me. You know, I try because it's, you know, whether it's, you know, fortunately it was for sobriety for me, but, you know, I've learned a lot through sobriety, not just about not drinking. I mean, I really, the drinking issue ended the day that I got sober, right? I mean, from that point, I did not have a drinking problem. So trying to understand that and learn that and then try to take that into, you know, because as a parent, you if you can avoid or help your children avoid like pitfalls in life, you're like, oh, bro, don't do that. You know, I've done it. It doesn't work out. But at the same time, but that's what creates the characters. You know, that's what creates, you know, the character of our kids, you know, going through these things. You know, if somebody come up to me and said, Tom, listen, if you don't do this, do this, don't do that, do this, you're going to be great. I wouldn't have listened. I'm like, I had to kind of go through everything that I went through to become the person that I am today. And it's hard to balance trying to avoid character creating moments in your kid's life. And, but still, you know, hopefully they don't, you know, hit the hard parts that you wish maybe we could have avoided.
If they don't have to go through those right. things. I say yeah. it to them all the time because, you know, they're at this stage. One's in college, one's a senior in high school. And I'm like, I'm just trying to save you the aggravation and the pain that it's going to cause you. But again, they got to.
Well, when you start saying these words, do you hear like your father?
I do.
It's fucking weird, man. It's been happening lately. And I'm like, my son was saying, we were talking about something and there was a moment I'm like, don't even bother. Okay. Don't bother. That's what I wanted to say. Don't bother. It's a waste of time. But I'm like, don't do it. I mean, I can't become, he's got to find that out on his own. And so trying to balance that out has been a little challenging for me lately.
I got a good piece of advice, and it was interesting because I don't know if you do it this way, but I do this, is I remember the scenario occurs, and I'm like, that's how I would have handled it. And so I'm immediately thinking, this is what my kids are doing. They already got a case of beer in the back seat. In the trunk of the car, they're already going to go over to this place house and do a pregame party before they get to wherever. And I'm guarding against it as a parent, you know what I mean? Cause I know my role is to not say, oh yeah, go ahead, get hammered. It'll be fun. While it might be for a period, it eventually leads to, you know, worse. But the cousin of mine gave me the same guy that read the book the very first time said, and it was a good piece of advice. He said, don't paint them with your brush. And I'm like, I struggle, Tim, to tell them not to do it because I know how I would have done it. And they're like, they're not you. And it's hard to believe that, although they're your kid and you think you understand how they think, they're not going to do everything.
Did your kids ever see you drink?
They did not. No, I quit when I was 20, and thankfully I haven't drank since. But I've told them a lot. They've read it. You know, they read the book.
I'm just, you know, because I don't blame my parents, but I do, like, just the whole story I went through about the party, the night of the party, you know.
Right.
It's something, you know, I see this, I hear this, it evolves, and then there's joy and cheer, and then it ends. And so as a child, you think, oh, well, I want to, you know, reproduce that. I want to reenact that, so to speak. And I think that I did do that a little bit. I don't blame my parents, but I definitely think, well, I think my mom smoking, and I think that was a big reason I started smoking.
Because it was an acceptable thing.
Yeah, and she would give us cigarettes. She didn't care.
The social fabric of Baltimore is really drinking heavy. And I'm not saying it's bad or good. I don't want to judge that in any way, but it was just I was accustomed to. You know, I mean, some people could handle it. I couldn't. Yeah. So.
Well, I guess I'm just wondering, so you still are concerned like about your kids drinking and stuff?
Sure. You know, I think every parent is, and I'm one of those where I'm like, this is where I'm coming from. This is what I put me through. Try not. I can't. I don't want to let you get to that stage.
Yeah.
So, and you know, they're growing up and they're going to experience, like you said, their things their way. And I'm just trying to give them a base of knowledge that says, hey, in our family, there's alcoholism and I'm not the only guy. You know what I mean? Yeah. I'll talk about it openly. Some don't, some do. But, you know, most importantly is this is the hand you're dealt. Make sure that you are aware of what hand you're playing.
So this book, is this basically a journey of your life?
It's a journey of a 10-year period of my life, yeah.
10-year period.
Yep.
So starting at what age?
Starting at about 14, 15.
And then ending, I guess, at 20.
So I'll tell you, the very beginning, like I said, I was a long-time lacrosse guy, and we start at the very beginning, and I'll give away the first few pages, which is we are ball boys. So if you know what that is, when you're a ball boy in lacrosse, you're basically on the end line rolling the ball back when somebody shoots and misses a goal. So that's the stage that we're in. We're 13 years old. We're innocent. It's the World Games. USA's playing Australia. It's an international thing. So there's Australians, there's English, there's Canadians, there's the United States team. It's at Johns Hopkins. It's under the lights. It's a hot summer night. And we have a great time. And we get to see the revelry of 25-year-old guys, 30-year-old men after they win. And then through the course of that night, I told you we were periphery experienced kids. Australia leaves their keg unattended because they'll go off and party with the Americans. Well, who's left with the keg but me and some of my ball boy friends? So at the age of 13, we go from being the innocent 13-year-old kid to getting away with everything we got away with while our parents are off, while the family's off, while everybody's off. We get the green light. We didn't get the green light. We took the green light. You know, we ran the red light, essentially,
right,
and did whatever we wanted. And that's how it starts. And there's more stories as it goes through, but it's not all about alcoholism. It's about your family. It's about when they're there for you, when they give you the tough love, all that stuff. So it's an interesting tale. It's funny. I hear people say, I laugh, I cry, I do all these things.
Can I read this?
Sure, go right ahead.
So the back of the book, it says, and I hope I don't screw this up. Here we go. What do we seek as we grow older? Is it love? Is it peace? Is it understanding? We ask questions of ourselves and others, and sometimes the answers come from the most unexpected sources. A teenage Mark spends his days like many other teenage youth playing sports, hanging out with friends, and finding his way through school. In a moment of vulnerability, his existing life is upended. The roller coaster of adventures that follows takes him places and shows him people that he never would have imagined. Remaining true to yourself and becoming someone new is a fine line and a delicate balance, one that many people face as they grow older. This tale shows the evolution of our growth is often different than even our own expectations, while we are influenced by people of all ages and backgrounds. I did that all right.
Yeah, that was good. That's pretty much the way I wanted it to sound.
Yeah. And I like that. I mean, you know, what do we seek as we grow older? I mean, that is a... I mean, do we... It's a... Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I don't... How old are you?
I'm 53.
So we're both 53.
Okay.
And at 53, I don't know if I seek... I think I seek serenity.
And at 20, what did we seek? At 30, what do we seek? You know, it's all changes as we grow. It's like the age-old question.
Well, what are we looking for? Getting sober at 20. I did not even want to. I mean, you know, I'd love to say, oh yeah, at this age I decided to get sober. But you know, I had to really peel it back because I didn't even want to get sober. I mean, it was an ego move. I didn't want to be embarrassed move that got me sober.
I was going to say, let me clarify. I didn't want to get sober.
Yeah.
No. I didn't want it. You know, that wasn't something that I thought, oh yeah, you know what? I'll do this year. I'll get sober.
I think it's important, honestly, for people to admit that.
Yeah. You know, I don't have any trouble.
If someone's sober and they said, you know, I don't even want to be sober, they would think that automatically they're getting drunk. I think it's very important that we're honest about the fact that, hey, this isn't really what I want to do. I clearly see the big picture. It's what I need to do. I always say, listen, if I could sit on the couch and drink vodka and watch SportsCenter and stay there, I'd do it.
And you had the ability, yeah, to do
but
it.
But I can't. Yeah. I take one sip and I'm like, let's drive. I'm a drunk driver. I drive drunk when I drink. And so that's why I ended up having to get sober. But I loved it. I would have still done it if it would work. It just don't work for me. But I think it's important that we be honest about that. You know, I've met people that think, if I say that I miss drinking, that means that I don't really want to be sober. And I think that it's not true.
If you're being honest, you just...
Absolutely.
You just recognize that it's going to lead me down the wrong road, so I just can't. That's the serenity part that I got, the admission of guilt, whatever you want to call it. Like, listen, I surrender.
Well, and I think there's a lot of people that are pretty honest. You know, I don't lie, but I'm not honest about stuff. You know, there's a difference. Right. And it's important, you know, just those kind of things, like, you know, whether it's relationships or, you know, getting sober. I mean, you have to say, listen, I miss drinking. I know that I can't do it. I know that it doesn't work for my life, But I would be lying to say that I didn't miss it. And I think that's the first step to getting better.
And there's periods now, even today, 30-something years later, that I'm like, man, it would be nice to have a beer. But
oh, my wife and I talk about it all the time. These cute, cool drinks that they have. Right. Anytime they're crushing some fucking leaves up in the glass and they're throwing some lime in it. We watched, we went down the Anthony Bourdain tunnel a couple months ago. I couldn't stop watching how much he drank. Parts unknown.
Right, right.
The dude is a pound in it. And at one point he's like, which is crazy. He goes, you know, he starts doing this like voiceover during the show. And he's like, at this point, I am blasted. He goes, I do not remember this conversation that you're about to watch. I don't remember who this person was. I don't remember being there.
But the camera was rolling.
Yeah. And the crazy part of it is that he's not slurring his words. He sounds perfectly like you would have never suspected that he's that drunk. And that reminded me of myself. That's how I was. I was completely functioning drunk. And, you know, I could drink a half a pint or a pint and sit right here and talk to you. You might not even know. If I did it now, you'd know. But
right.
In my...
in your experience.
Yeah, days. In the deepest, darkest point, I could drink that and you wouldn't even know. And that's all that I kept watching. But, you know, it's a sad... especially when you have nobody in your life that pushes back. And that's what I picked from him in that show, is that he just got to do, you know, if you and I drink, maybe a wife or a job or something would say, hey, that isn't working. But if your job is to drink and that's what they're promoting, there's nothing stopping you.
And he had just been not allowed, but yeah, it was tolerated, whatever the best word is.
So sad. I don't know.
So there's a period in there where then the light shines. You know what I mean? Once you come out of rehab, once you started getting some optimism, some hope, you're realizing some of that hope, and then you're just moving forward. It's an interesting tale because I just take it further.
So do you still? I mean, I don't want to. You know, it's your business.
Go ahead.
You know, answer what you want. But I mean, do you still focus? Is it a priority? Your sobriety a priority today?
Yeah, I take it more for granted, I should say. You know what I mean? I don't have to work on it as hard because it's just not part of the routine. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I still talk to people, still spend time with people.
Because that's our job now, is really to be there for the next person.
Yeah, and so that's what I get the fulfillment in. Yeah. I don't go to as many meetings as I used to because I just feel like... you got three kids. You know, you're busy. I'm not trying to make excuses.
I was doing one meeting. I still go to meetings. I absolutely still, but COVID, I mean, prior to COVID, I was doing probably three meetings a week.
Okay.
And then after COVID, none. And then I started hitting this Monday night meeting because I need to be at a meeting. I enjoy at least one. I mean, when I first got sober, I did 120 meetings in 90 days.
In 90 days. Yeah. I was going all the time.
Yeah.
I can still learn it. You never can stop learning. It's just that I focus on it and it's more of a part of the routine of an everyday as opposed to, I'm not nervous about picking up a drink. So I can feel good about helping others and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. But after I started hitting this, I went back to this Monday night meeting and I've been going, but then school started again and everything just changed and I haven't been able to get to a meeting and I told my wife I got to find another meeting.
I liked one some more than others and you
there's
know
a when Wednesday I'm, night meeting at Epworth that's good. There's great meetings as long as they're open. I mean, but Epworth, they put out a couple good meetings that I'll get back to. I got to go.
Yeah, I work with a couple people that are sober too, so the routine in our day to talk about it is helpful. You know, we just something we talk about.
Yeah, there is a, and you can tell me what, or I don't know whether you feel this or not, but to me, meetings should suck. You know, that should be a fucking inconvenience. It shouldn't be. I always say, if this meeting's better than what you were doing at home, this is a social event.
I think it should make you feel, not awkward, but it should make you feel uncomfortable.
It's an inconvenience.
It should make you feel.
The problem that we have, the problem that got us to where we were is because about self. We'd done everything self wanted. So that's what meetings are. It's the same with church. You know, I was talking about this a little while ago. You know, church should suck. You know, it's an inconvenience. It's at a terrible time in the morning. You got to dress up. There used to be rules, you know, but we've, you know, give and take now. You know, that kneeler used to be wood. You used to get on that bitch and you'd be like, this sucks. This hurts my knees. But you did it for the Lord. But now we put a pad on it, you know, because we are getting soft, which is fine. I don't care. But, you know, it should be an inconvenience. And I think people, you know, I've watched, I mean, I got sober in 97 and I'll celebrate 13 years this year. So that just shows you that I haven't been sober the whole time. And it's been an interesting journey. But I've learned a lot about it. And but, you know, it's an inconvenience.
Meetings like church, I was going to bring that up, are, but you should feel good when you leave. You know, if you do, if you got the mental attitude, you should feel good when you leave. You should have gotten something out of it. If you're listening.
Well, even the fact that self wanted what self wanted and you chose to not do what self wanted and came out on the other side. Yeah, that is a miracle in itself. So obvious. I mean, I remember when I had to, when I celebrated my first year and you know, I don't know. A lot of times you get a coin, you set up front, you know, you share
how people clap for you.
Yeah. And I remember just being freaking petrified. Oh my God, I can't do this. And I was so, and it was self. It's self that's going, you can't do this, man. Don't do it. And I'm like, I'm doing it. And it's like, come on, don't do it. Well, let's not do this. This is a real opportunity to be embarrassed. Don't do it. And I said, I am doing it. And self said, all right, I'll be over here. And sat in the corner while I did it.
Peeled off the layers, yeah, and then exposed humility yourself.
Showed up, and I was like, "Oh my God, that is the gift."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is,
and that's so. You know, that's why. Like, if you go to a meeting or you go to church, it's a pain in the butt. It's an inconvenience. You know, we've made it better, but the reality is, you're taking the time out of yourself, of your day, to, you know, dedicate it to the Lord or to sobriety or whatever it is. And actually, after it's all said and done, yes. You should and probably do feel better.
There's an awareness, I feel like, that comes with it. If you're listening, you know, if you're listening, you're like, I picked that up. Picked that up today.
Yeah. Well, it's a, I go to meetings. I don't go to church. It's weird. I'm not even a big believer. So what's the book? So do we have, are you going to do an audiobook? Are you going to read it yourself?
I haven't done an audiobook yet. It's on Kindle, and so it's on Amazon, More Than One Goal. And I'm going to do an audiobook next. That's the thing.
More Than One Goal. Do you have a Instagram?
I don't. I got a Facebook.
Mark.
I know. I'm working. I'm a one-man gang.
Mark.
Right.
Start your Instagram. Start reading. No, it sucks. It's a bitch being older and trying to be like
It's funny because I'm going to get my kids I'm going to sick my kids on them. They're going to be the ones who take care of all this for me.
Well, you should have an Instagram for the book at least. And, you know.
I would like to put this podcast on it.
On the Instagram?
Yeah, if I can. Or, you know, a link to it so that we can.
You can do a link. You can't play podcasts through Instagram at this point. Facebook is now allowing them.
Okay.
But we'll put this podcast go everywhere. We'll have it out.
Yeah. So it's been a really neat process to. Communication with people that have gotten some out of it. So we were talking, you were like, is this a lacrosse book? Really, it was interesting because one of the people who read it initially, who I respect and is a professional and all that stuff, said, this is a book more about sobriety and self than it is about lacrosse. So take some of that out. And so I removed some of it. You know, they were like, it's cool. It's a cute story, but people aren't identifying with that, but they all can identify
with what? The lacrosse?
With the lacrosse stuff, yeah. They're like, unless you're a Northeasterner or you're suddenly into it. I also wrote it because there's a lot of people who have been introduced to the game through their kids, and I want them to recognize the fact that it's been around for a long time. These are some of the references that I use are old school, kind of what I grew up in, which was in the 1980s, and they could learn a little bit about the game as well as the story itself.
Yeah, it sounded like you were kind of in a predicament. You had a book. It sounds like your book was kind of one thing with a little of the sobriety sprinkled in, and then it's kind of evolved into more of a sobriety kind of thing and a little less of the lacrosse.
It was, yeah. Well, it was always the sobriety. I just took out the lacrosse and then accentuated some of the other things later, too. They were like, you need to not fix the ending, but keep going as a more mature grown-up than the kid before he starts drinking or as he's drinking. You know, that was the interesting part to it all. But what we end up with, I feel like, is pretty cool because it's just something that I think people can identify with.
Is this the first of many, or is it one and done?
I got another subject that I want to write on, but, you know, it's like right now it's I've done this. I'm pretty much done. And then I've started writing some other stuff. So I'd like to keep doing it because there's, you know, Tom, you can make observations about life in general. And I try to sprinkle them in as, you know, just observations about life. Things that come to you now that didn't come to me as a kid that I think are, you know, whether they're beneficial, whether they're thought-provoking, whatever it might be. But so I'd like to keep writing just because I like, you know, whether I'm not saying I like putting it out there, I like putting it on paper and then, you know, what people can take out of it, they can take out of it. But I like to kind of put my thoughts down on paper.
Well, it's weird because, you know, a high road, white flag waving kind of lifestyle is not very exciting.
It isn't. It isn't. You got to entertain it.
I got a good friend, and him and I, we butt heads sometimes and stopped talking, and finally we had coffee last week, and I said, you know, the fucked up part is that all the parts that I love are all the that I love about you are really all the parts that you need to change.
Oh, the flawed parts. Yeah, well, that's like, it. I'm like flawed to beyond belief. So yeah, I don't have trouble with that.
It's, you know, you want to promote a more, you know, humble, I hate saying it over and over, but just like a white flag waving kind of moment, this high road, you know, there was a time my father and I, we were always fighting and just really clashing. And I remember I said to him, I said, listen, you're getting old. I would prefer that we would spend, you know, the rest of your time, at least, hopefully not my time, but your time, in a more of a pleasant way, you know,
enjoying each other.
You know, we got here, we made it, right? Let's stop fighting. And I had to wave the white flag. We had come to this moment. We'd gotten in an argument again. I was like, you know, F you. I'm out of here. My mom's, don't run out. You know how moms are. And I'm like, I'm out of this place. And I remember halfway out, I stopped and I said, you know, this is that moment where I need to wave the white flag. I don't need to be right. And I said to him, I said, why don't we try and make effort to not do this anymore? And let's have the best, you know, life we can have for the rest of our time together. And we both agreed, and we've done that. But it's not very exciting.
I was just going to disagree with you, because I was going to say all you did was just recognize all the flaws that you are well aware of, and as a result of it, then it becomes not boring. Then it becomes boring because you're like, all right, we're going to finally get along. Right. But if you can identify that, I think a lot of people can identify with that. Is I guess what I'm saying. And that's what I've found in the character is if you recognize the flaws, you're willing to admit to them. And a lot of people may not, but they know of themselves. They can recognize it in themselves. They might not admit it out loud, but that's what I think of people can identify with is we're all flawed in some way.
Of course.
Way more than others. Some way more than others, some in different ways. But, you know, there's a lot of things to work through in this day and age.
Alcohol muted me. Alcohol and drugs muted me. And and it was tough. And it would be, you know, having to get sober and start to understand that I've been on mute. And that's from feelings and voice coming out. And that's from feelings and voices coming in. And I remember getting sober. And I just remember how emotionally concerned I was for squirrels. I was like, oh, my God, I cannot run over a squirrel. It was just this new, I'd been kind of, you know, muting myself for a long time. And then to have those feelings like, oh my God, please don't let me run over a squirrel. I would be just broken up of the idea, but these were new feelings. But trying to understand that, I remember a word came up pretty early on in my sobriety. It was called rightly. And it was, I've used this as an example. I would go and, you know, prior to getting sober, I would go to the grocery store and buy something. I'd be the guy that would leave the cart between the cars. Fuck it. What do I care?
Right.
Less time I got to spend doing something, more time for me.
Right.
And then when I got sober, I remember thinking, I'm better now. So now I'm going to take this cart all the way to the door. Right. Because right. I'm better. I'm sober. I'm better. I'm at another level of better. And so I would be taking that car all the way back to the front of the store, but at the same time, trying to see if anybody would notice what I'm doing. Like, look at that guy. He is freaking awesome. He's taking the cart back up. And so understanding my motivation behind some of the stuff that I was doing, was I doing it rightly? And I wasn't. And getting sober was trying, you know, you have this opportunity to be a lot better. I mean, I always say, if you live in the manure and then you finally come out, you think that the fresh air is from God, when actually the fresh air has always been here. You've just been living in the shit for so long.
Yeah.
And that's how it was when I got sober. Anything that I did. Look at me, guys. I'm not driving drunk. Let's have a freaking parade. I am awesome. I'm not drunk. Put me up on your shoulders. Hoist me up and show how awesome I am. And it was a lot of work to be normal.
It was a lot more than you thought.
It was a lot more work than I thought to just be normal. So just trying to understand that, trying to, you know, it exposed a lot of weird stuff with me, you know, the self-centered side of me that I didn't really, I thought I just had a drinking problem.
It's funny because now,
hold on a second.
No, that's cool. Gotten, and you know, I want to kind of put it out there because I feel like it's a story worth telling. It's a story people can learn from. The emails, and it hits with women too. I know it sounds goofy, so I got a cousin who's written a book. A different cousin, she's written several books, and her name's Kelly Corrigan. She wrote The Middle Place. She wrote I can't think of the other names off the top of my head, but she's written some, Tell Me More. She's been on Oprah and all that stuff, so she's a good writer. And it was funny because she says to me, "So who's your target audience?" And I said, it's adult subject matter, by the way. I said, 18
not
to 80.
Not for kids?
Not for kids still probably in middle school and even early in high school. But she said, who's your target audience? I said, I don't know, 18 to 80, men and women. She said, don't be ridiculous. Nobody does that. You need like 20 to 35 men. And I was like, I'm 18 to 80, men and women. I'm sticking with that story. And she was like, really? And I said, read it. You tell me what you think. And she called me back and she said, a lot of people can identify with that. So, I don't have a target audience. You know what I mean? I just wrote it because I thought it was an interesting story.
Well, listen, I think it's great. I just think it's great you wrote a book.
Thanks.
It's not an easy task. I've talked to a lot of people that want to write a book. I've talked to, I know some people that have written several.
Right.
So it's not easy. I've tried to manipulate people to help me write the book for me. That's it. That doesn't happen either. So it's a labor of love, and I appreciate you did it. So it's more than one goal, a story about strength, hope, faith, family, and the power of love.
You got it.
And thank you for the book. I'll read it.
Appreciate it. Thanks for letting me come in today.
So we'll look for your Instagram, but you are on Facebook. Do you have a Facebook page for this book, or is it just your personal Facebook?
It's my personal Facebook, and then it has a link to More Than One Goal.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's on Amazon. Feel free to read away.
All right, buddy.
Thanks again.
Talk later.